But I understand you have been instrumental in the Montgomery bus integration fight.
Well, I have. I was in Montgomery at the time of Rosa Parks' arrest.
Mm-hmm.
And I was one of the ministers who held that first meeting in which the Montgomery Improvement Association was born.
It's interesting to me that you took on the name, the Montgomery Improvement Association. These are mostly the names that, at least in communities around here, white people take on in order to keep Negroes out of housing in their communities. You realize this, I presume, and you did this probably with intent, right?
Well, yes. What we were intending to do or attempting to show was that we were not just attempting to ride the buses, but we wanted to improve the status not only of the Negro, but of all people in Montgomery.
So your peculiar reasoning being that if you improve the status of the Negro, you will improve the white man's conscience.
That's right, that's right.
And therefore make him a better man.
That's right, that's right. And you know, we were using and are using the weapon of love, total non-resistance.
You really love those white men?
Well, yes. Yes, we do. I can't say that we love all their deeds, but we've gone a long way to show what love really means. And it has been far more effective, even on us, than you might think. Mm-hmm. It has been a weapon that has really done a great job.
You know, love as a weapon sounds to me very incongruous.
But it isn't. It's one of the most effective weapons that you can use. For an example, during the first month or two of this protest, the city commissions of Montgomery put on what they call the Get Tough policy.
Mm-hmm.
And we were emphasizing the nonviolence in all of our attitude. And it's surprising to know how the reaction of those policemen were, and the all of the police officials, shall I say,
mm-hmm.
were to the nonviolent act. We became submissive to whatever they did. We paid the fines. We didn't protest. The only thing we did was to walk and absolutely stay off the buses. And it has won for us many, many friends, even in Montgomery, and that who have not ever given their names, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that has been demonstrated in the hiring of Negroes. And a number of people have kept their help. If they had let their help go, they would have crippled us severely.
Mm-hmm.
But because of our attitude and their respect for it, they kept the Negro help.
You said you were one of the ministers who organized the Montgomery Improvement Association.
Yes, I was president of the Interdenominational Alliance, and it was organized in the Alliance. I presided over the first three or four meetings of it.
How was this idea born?
It was born in the minds of many citizens because of the brutality of the bus drivers. The bus drivers in Montgomery have police power.
And they have,
they have police power to not necessarily arrest, but they arrange the seating to their own discretion. And it is against the law to disobey the ordinance of a bus driver.
Mm-hmm.
And because of that, there was a great deal of brutality manifested by them, particularly those who were, the less intelligent. Not all the bus drivers were harsh. Not all of them were hard to get along with. But there were those who were particularly so. And our protest was born against their treatment of Negro passengers. And a number of Negro passengers would pay their fare at the front of the bus and would have to go back to the rear of the bus to board it. And by the time they would get there, the driver would have driven off, leave them, take their fare, and leave them standing. They had certain sections reserved for white, and certain sections for Negroes, and any number of times Negroes would stand over those empty buses. They could lay their packages, if they had packages in their hand, they could lay them on the seat, mm-hmm. but were not permitted to sit on it.
Mm-hmm. But what the question I mean when I ask how the Montgomery Improvement Association was born is, is this. What gave you the idea to form this organization and to proceed as you did in a nonviolent protest, a walking the streets?
We called a meeting after Rosa Parks' arrest, and I'm sure you know that episode. We called
that
a meeting.
That was more than a year ago now.
That's right, yes. It was December the 2nd in 55.
55, yeah.
We called a meeting of the ministers and the interested laymen to see what might be done. That was maybe the second or third reoccurrence of this thing. And we called this
meeting. Now, you ministers had a ministerial association,
that's
I understand.
Right, that's
and
right.
You probably announced this meeting from the pulpits.
Well, not the first meeting. The first meeting was called by interested people. Maybe someone would call you and ask you to meet at Martin Luther King's church that mm-hmm. night mm-hmm. without saying anything about who they were, just to come on down because Mrs. Parks had been arrested. And let's see if we can't do something about it.
Mm-hmm.
And we met, maybe 50, 75, or 100.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody knew the nature of the meeting. We had no agenda. And when we got there, it was asked that the ministers would take charge. And I, being the president, naturally, it fell to my lot to preside over. We decided that night that we would call a mass meeting Monday night. And in the meantime, we asked all Negroes to stay off the buses Monday, December the 5th, during Mrs. Parks' trial.
Mm-hmm.
We were so successful in keeping them off the first day. Until in that mass meeting, we asked everybody to stay off until we had gotten some of the things we were asking for.
Mm-hmm.
We asked for three propositions. The first was we wanted more courtesy on the buses mm-hmm. to a Negro citizen. The second was we wanted the seating arrangement changed to the first-come, first-served basis, particularly in the predominantly Negro area.
Mm-hmm.
And the third was we wanted Negro bus drivers at the earliest convenience. And those were the three things we were asking for. And we asked our people to walk until those things were done. And that's how the protest was born, and it is how it has proceeded. And fortunately, they walked until they were able to get at least the first two. The Supreme Court outlawed segregation on public transportation in both the city and state of Alabama, Montgomery and Alabama.
Uh-huh.
And we've gone back to the buses now.
Mm-hmm. You think this is good, that the Supreme Court outlawed segregation?
Well, yes. Yes, it's good not only for us, but I think it's good for our international life.
Yes. But you just told me a moment ago that several Negro parsonages were bombed last night or very recently. Is that not true?
That is true, yes. I heard this morning, I haven't heard from the association as yet to know which churches or parsonages were bombed, but I heard over the air this morning that four Negro churches were bombed last night, three Negro churches and a Negro church that has a white pastor was bombed last night, and it means that they are continuing their violent attitude.
They weren't bombing you while you were walking, were they?
Well, yes, there were two or three bombings.
They were.
Mm-hmm. There were two or three bombings. Martin Luther King's home was bombed. He is the president now of the MIA. And Nixon, one of the officers of the organization's home, was bombed.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe Gret's home was bombed once before.
Mm-hmm.
He and his family were away. So occasionally there was bombing and mild violence. But now they are resorting to, it would seem, the stepped-up tempo, should we say, of their of violence. But no matter what happens, something must be done. Nothing could be worse than conditions were before we staged this protest.
Yeah, that's true. But I am wondering about the best way to achieve your ends. You have espoused a method of nonviolence, of love, of continuing protest. And now you have achieved your end formally through a Supreme Court directive which carries behind it the implicit power of the federal government, troops, if necessary. And there seems to be stepped-up violence as the result of this force. Force meets force. I wondered how you looked at that.
Years ago, in a different form, the protest of Negro mail carriers was the same. And that soon blew over, and today Negro mail carriers are accepted in all parts of the South, like they are in a place else.
Mm-hmm.
It was because somebody said it must be done. And we believe that if the Supreme Court speaks, that's the only thing we need. If the Supreme Court speaks and stands by its mandate, mm-hmm. violence will stop.
Mm-hmm.
Clinton, Tennessee has an integrated school now. It's because the Attorney General said that it must be. And
then
it
you
was.
Do believe in force as well as love.
Well, not necessarily on our part.
Just another weapon in your arsenal.
Yes, we are using the nonviolent method. We are using the force of love.
Mm-hmm.
And that isn't just saying something. That means that we are really taking it on the chin. No matter what anybody says, no matter what anybody does, we are going on. But we intend to do that until we accomplish our aim. And the result has been already, the Supreme Court has, I think, knows now, not only the Supreme Court, but the federal government knows now that the Negro in the South is going to protest until he gets his rights. I think everybody knows that. And we are beginning more and more to get recognition. And so I think we have done the right thing. I think we've mm-hmm. gone after it the right way.
Mm-hmm. You see, a little while ago, too, you told me that you had been born and reared in North Carolina, and that up until very recently, North Carolina was the most advanced and progressive of the southern states with respect to equal rights for Negroes. But that most recently, North Carolina has reverted to become one with Mississippi and Alabama as far as these things are concerned. Now, why is this true?
It is true. Because the I think North Carolina resents being told what to do.
Mm-hmm.
It was going a long way, but it wasn't going as far as it should have gone.
Mm-hmm.
For an example, few Negroes in North Carolina vote, and until Negroes get the ballot, they will never have their equal rights.
Mm-hmm.
Taxation without representation isn't fair.
Mm-hmm.
It isn't fair there, and so North Carolina has stepped up its protest, should I say, to keep the ballot from the Negro. Their school system is fine.
In response to being told by the Supreme Court what they must do.
That's right. I think that has a great deal to do with the violence, and not as much having been told what they should do as it was knowing what would actually happen if the Negro in North Carolina had the ballot.
What would?
Well, they would have far more rights than they have. For an example, in all of the southern states, police brutality is pronounced in all of the southern states. That's one of the things where people don't vote. They have no rights, and that anybody respects. But do you know, it so happens that everybody respects the ballot, no matter who casts it. Whether he's black or white or whatnot, if he has a ballot, he has the respect of the ballot. And Negroes in North Carolina know that when they get the ballot, conditions will change very greatly. Not only do the Negroes know it, but everybody does. And for that reason, I think white in North Carolina has become far more segregationist than they were, than was represented on the surface before.
Yes. You think that the way for the Negro to get the ballot in the South, however, is, in this case probably, through federal legislation implementing the Constitution?
Very much so. I think that very definitely.
Not through some sort of protest which wells up from the Negro himself in the South and is carried out by your method of nonviolence and love to actuate the Southern white person, white states, governments to give it to him.
Well, we must continue the protest, and we must continue the protest until the federal government comes to our rescue. This thing now has taken on such a proportion of, I don't want to say propaganda, but I would like to say publicity, until it has become a world problem. Everybody knows now what goes on in the South. And until we do something about that, I am of the opinion that our voice is weak when it comes to giving direction to underprivileged people over the world.
I think this is perfectly true, and I think that I wouldn't want to even question your remarks about the foreign effects of our discrimination in the South, and for that matter, all over the United States. I suppose there's some discrimination. I was really asking, and I think you were giving me, in part at least, the stock and standard Southern white answer to my question. The Southern white person who says, if you impose this on us through your federal government, we'll fight it. We'll fight it as much as possible. We may go down eventually, but we'll never accept it. Now, this kind of reasoning makes me think that if it's true, your victory may not be real, though it be won. Unless it is achieved, perhaps, through the complete extension of the technique that you in Montgomery have so successfully engineered. But I may be wrong.
Believe it or not, all Americans are law-abiding people. No matter how we howl about it before it's done, before the law is passed, America at heart is law-abiding. And once it becomes the law of the land, they will abide by it. Mm-hmm. For an example, in our national election, and this may be a little foreign, but perhaps it will strengthen what I'm attempting to say, you would think during the campaign that nobody on the opposite side would ever even look around at whoever was elected, the way we campaign. Mm-hmm. But once a president is nominated and elected, he is everybody's president. Mm-hmm. No matter whether he's a Republican or Democrat, everybody abides by his rules and regulations as far as that goes. Mm-hmm. And the same thing is true in the South. When the Supreme Court implements its mandate, they will be obeyed. I'm sure of that because we've had, as I mentioned a moment ago, in Clinton, Tennessee, those 13 Negroes, those 9 Negroes who were integrated in this white high school are going to school now without any disturbance whatsoever. Mm-hmm. There was a great to-do about it in the beginning, but it soon passed over. And it passed over when Governor Clement, I believe it is, of Tennessee sent the National Guard in there to keep mm-hmm. order. They knew then that he meant integration. And they were integrated. Mm-hmm. And that's true in the...
What are the Negroes' real goals?
Full and complete citizenship in every sense of the word. We are not concerned about social equality.
You're not?
No, we are. That doesn't enter the equation.
Just legal and political equality.
Yes, that's right. And when I say social equality, I'm thinking in terms of intermarriage. The Negro isn't interested in that.
Why not?
Well, he isn't. He isn't. He's happy to be as he is. He would like to stay as he is, should I put it. He is as proud of being a pure-blood Negro.
There aren't any, are there?
Well, there are a few. There are a few.
Well, then this doesn't really hold, does it?
No, it doesn't.
If there are only a very few.
Very few, very few. But the Negro isn't interested in social equality, into marriage and the like, but he is interested.
Is this a reaction to white propaganda about miscegenation?
Oh, yes. Oh, certainly. That's propaganda. That's propaganda you hear everywhere.
No, I mean the Negro saying that he's not interested in social equality. Is this a reaction to this propaganda?
No, it's not a reaction. It's an actuality. He really isn't interested in that. But... He is interested.
He is not interested in individual freedom, then, so far as it applies to picking a marrying mate.
Well, that isn't his objective. Let's put it that way, then. Perhaps that answers your question. If it were if it were the desires of two persons of different races to intermarry, the Negro wouldn't object. That is, but that isn't his goal. It isn't to. He isn't fighting for integration in order that he might intermarry.
Well, now, if he gets the vote, should he not see to it that if there are laws against intermarriage, as I believe there are in southern states, that these laws should be abolished?
So I don't think so.
So that individuals could decide for themselves?
No, I don't
think...
Wouldn't
that be freedom in the true sense of the constitutional sense of that word?
Well, it would be, but that would be carrying it a little far. I don't think that that has entered the mind of the southern Negro at all, intermarry. But that is the boogaboo that they set up to offset everything else. That's Eastland's philosophy, that the Negro wants to enter his home, wants to associate with his daughter, and wants his son to associate with the Negro.
Seems strange to me that the Negro doesn't set up a little counter-propaganda to the effect that, after all, if we all had a little Negro blood in us, we'd have a built-in suntan, and we'd be just a little bit more coffee-colored, and, you know, everybody'd be happy. There'd be no basis for discrimination, and you couldn't tell.
No. That would be missing the point altogether, I think. Basically, what we want is a first-class citizenship. We're happy to remain two-blooded Negro. And we feel if we had the ballot, it would be a better chance to remain two-blood, if you follow me, because we do have...
Well, I follow you to a certain extent. We went over this before as to how pure you are.
Yeah, well, that's right. And it is our fault. Should I say?
I agree.
Mm-hmm. So we would, if you're going to discuss that, of course we would, we aren't interested in intermarriage, but we do believe that it is fair one way through the fence that it would be through the other. So if there's going to be any passing through the fence, the gate should be open both ways. But we'd be happy to keep the gate closed forever.
Isn't this the basis of many white Southerners' reaction against integration?
That's what it is. That's the propaganda that he sets up to smokescreen his real meaning.
Propaganda?
Yes, it's propaganda against
integration.
You
mean the fact that when children, students, go to school and are together a great deal on an equal basis, that they're not likely to intermarry?
No. I don't think there will be any intermarrying in the South for a long, long, long time. And I don't think either group, particularly of children, is thinking of it.
In other words, the kind of integration you'll get in the schools is the kind that we have in certain northern cities, where the Negroes all go stand in one corner and the whites all stand in another corner, and they keep very much apart in their social relationships. They don't go to dances together, they don't do anything together, really, except sit in the same classroom.
That's right, but...
And this is desirable, huh?
Well, it's desirable on a voluntary basis. You see, we don't want it compulsory. You don't want to be made to sit in a certain corner. Even if you are integrated, we feel that whatever goes on should go on. Mm-hmm. Whatever it takes to give a person a complete education, and that includes his physical education and whatever is implied in an education, we feel that he should have his share, and not on a segregated basis either. If the Negroes elect to stand in the corner, or if all the white elect to stand in a corner, then let them do it. But if you want to go in that corner, you don't want any barriers, Negroes only or white only, as we had in many of the...
No signs, only social mores.
That's right. That's what I'm trying to say, absolutely. Let the mores in the minds of each group govern his social activities.
What about economic equality?
That's what we're fighting for. Economic equality.
That's another of your goals.
That's right, because the Negro is the first, the last hired and the first fired. He doesn't have access to jobs that pay in a certain category, no matter what his qualification is. And we feel that very keenly here. If a person is qualified for a job, he should have the job. If he's best qualified for it. Doesn't matter whether he's what his color is. That's one of our goals. Mm-hmm. Does that answer your question?
Yes, pretty well, I think, unless you have other goals that you would like to point up.
Well, economic and political goals and the like are those for which we are fighting, particularly for civil rights. And we think of civil rights as including all of the basic rights of an individual. He wants justice at the law, at the hands of the law. Everybody knows that he doesn't get justice in the South. It's hard for a Negro in fact, he can't get the AAA insurance, automobile insurance in the South, because everybody knows that he is responsible for the wreck. No matter whether he is hit, he's responsible for being hit, and he's certainly responsible for hitting with his automobile. So we feel that civil rights would eliminate those inequalities.
Have people like yourself, ministers, other Negro leaders, any plans for extension of the method that you've used in the Montgomery strike to other areas?
Yes, it is spreading.
Not only areas like in Atlanta, for example, where the ministers are doing the same thing with respect to transportation, but I mean in other areas of life, like in the method of getting the vote, or securing equal judicial treatment, or protesting police brutality. Do you have any ideas of using this method in those areas?
Oh yes. We're going to carry the fight on until we have gotten equal justice.
How?
In every area.
Just how can you do this?
Well, we are going to continue to protest. For an example, we won't be able to walk that type of justice out.
No.
We won't be able to demonstrate it in that way. But we shall continue to register until we are able to vote. One of the besetting sins in the South is the ballot. Mm-hmm. We had a member of our group to go down 19 times in Montgomery to register to vote, and he finally registered the 19th time. He was a teacher of history in State College, had his Ph.D. Mm-hmm. So you know they couldn't deny him the ballot on his qualification. They couldn't say he wasn't qualified. And those are some of the things that we would like to have eliminated from the those barriers removed, should I put it.
Mm-hmm. But you can't organize a mass going down to register.
Oh, yes, that's what we are doing.
You're doing that?
Yes, we have already set up in the MIA. That's one of the reasons we called it the Montgomery Improvement Association.
Yes.
We want to improve his status in every walk of life.
Yes.
And we have already voting clinics in our churches and in various organizations.
Mm-hmm.
We have voting clinics where we are teaching the people how to vote and how to acquire the ballot.
You're teaching them so that they can pass these literacy tests and
that sort of thing they impose.
Mm-hmm.
And
then they go down and stand in line to register
time
after time until finally maybe they will.
That's right. We go there and stand. The way they have perhaps in many counties, they have one register for Negroes, and this register works as slowly as possible. It's killed all the time he possibly can, some say. And if that is the case, we are prepared to just go there and wait and wait and wait until he does something about the crowd. And just wait it out.
You get a favorable press when you do things like that?
Yes, we do. We do. One of the things we must remember, everybody in the South isn't bad. That's your race.
Mm-hmm.
We have some very fine friends in the South. And those friends would like to see equal justice everywhere. And I think one of the byproducts of our nonviolence has been to show to them that we were real and sincere in our effort.
Thank you very much, Reverend Bennett.
Thank you.